production into Clint and to the Troy Society. And congratulations again to all of the winners of the prizes that that you've given. I mean, it really is an honor for all of us. So congratulations to all of you. I'm going to speak for between 15 and 20 minutes, and then I know that all of you know either knew Doc or knew of him, so I'm sure that there'll be lots of discussion, and we have Gord Jurenko here, and David Finch, and Bob Bott for starts, so anyway. American author and broadcaster Tom Brokaw called the U.S. veterans of World War II the greatest generation. And here's my husband, who was not part of the greatest generation, but he's bringing me water. So, and I'll apologize. I've got a cold, of course. So, Canadian authors have perhaps not spent enough time and words on our own greatest generation, who endured the Great Depression, courageously fought in World War II, and emerged to build modern Canada. And my dad was one of those. He was a Spitfire pilot in the Battle of Britain and was a flight lieutenant and rose to become acting squadron leader, because we know what happened to a lot of the pilots in the Battle of Britain. And my mom, my uncles joined the service in World War II. This is what they did. And Doc was one of them. The story of Darrell Kenneth Seaman, Doc to all of us, illuminates all the best qualities of the veterans who became nation builders. The generosity, love of country, and self-reliance. These men and women wanted to do things, not have things done for them. They were Canada's nation builders, and they lived the values that shaped our modern country. Born in Rolo, Saskatchewan, now best known as the scene of Corner Gas, television's Corner Gas, Doc grew up in the hard scrabble times in Western Canada. He knew risk from his early years riding a steel-tracked caterpillar alone in the darkness of the prairie with lightning snapping across the horizon. After World War II broke out, a teenage Doc joined the Royal Canadian Air Force, piloting a Hudson bomber, ducking German junkers and Messerschmitts, climbing to the clouds to stay alive. He flew an extremely high and rare total of 82 sorties. When I spoke with Dave Berkeson about that, who was Canada's ranking military historian, he was absolutely astonished. And one time, Doc limped back to base with a dead radio man behind him after they'd been attacked, his own leg shattered and tied to the rudder, and his crew's lives riding on Doc's uncertain ability to stay conscious on that ride back. Having witnessed the devastation of the Depression, Doc's main goal was to create jobs for other people, and he vowed to do this when he was very young. Seeing the horror of war, he also vowed to make a difference for all those who didn't return. Doc and his brothers BJ and Don made their mark in Alberta's burgeoning oil and gas industry, where Doc turned his meager war savings into a tiny drilling company. His $6,000 investment grew into Bow Valley Industries, a global energy powerhouse that, at its height, was a top trader on the then American Stock Exchange. Doc risked his very existence on frontiers within and beyond Canada, discovering huge reserves off Newfoundland's Grand Banks, Europe's North Sea, and on Indonesia's island of Sumatra. Against many odds, some imposed by his own country, National Energy Program anyone, Doc became one of the creators of a great Canadian industry. His perseverance and adaptability were astonishing. Peter C. Newman, in his book Titans, called Doc the totem of the Titans. In 1994, Talisman Energy bought Bow Valley's oil and gas assets and just recently sold the North Sea ones and has done very well by those assets, as we know. Doc's interests were extremely varied. He became a member of the McDonnell Commission that recommended the North American Free Trade Agreement. And he was one of those who urged then-Finance Minister Michael Wilson to adopt free trade. And I talked with Michael Wilson about that, and yes, indeed. Doc was a mentor to a legion of Canadian entrepreneurs who respect his integrity as well as his ability to drive a hard but fair bargain. Over time, Doc built companies that produced thousands of jobs and spun off funds for his many philanthropies, from medical science to social well-being to community sports. He also championed Aboriginal business programs through Western Lakota, which is now Savannah Energy Services, developing First Nations training and partnerships in the oil and gas drilling business. Doc was the key player, in bringing the Flames to Calgary. With the National Hockey League franchise, Calgary was able to build the Saddle Dome, the centerpiece of the city's successful bid for the 1988 Winter Olympics. Doc played a large role in rescuing Canadian amateur hockey from growing mediocrity, thus sending Canadian teams back to medal podiums at the Olympics and World Championships. Canada's World Junior Hockey wins have their roots in Project 75, and now called, as it should have been called all along, the Seaman Hotchkiss Hockey Foundation. And of course, that's Harley Hotchkiss, another grand, grand man known to all of you. Doc also saved a huge chunk of southern Alberta ranching land from environmental ruin when the Canadian military wanted it for training operations. The historic OH Ranch spans the foothills nestled just below the eastern slopes of the Rockies, and we know that it's some of the most beautiful land on this earth. It is conserved now as a working ranch for the people of Alberta and Canada, as a living example of our national heritage. There was a rare moment in Doc's life when he thought he might retire. Yet he became busier than ever, fueled by the conviction that boredom kills. His mission was to convince Canadians to stay active, to never quit, and to give back to community. And when I was doing research for the book, I found that he's absolutely right. There's fabulous research being done in Australia that shows, basically, when you stop, everything else does too. So you got to keep going. And I see some people here nodding. We all know you never quit. Useful people really do live longer, and they enjoy themselves more. Doc Seaman was one of the last of a breed of post-war entrepreneurs who made deals on a handshake. He risked all to keep his word, when many others would have found a side door and just simply slithered up. Never Doc. His story is a remarkable saga of courage, resolve, struggle, disappointment, and success. While Doc is no longer with us, it is his values that need to be respected, honored, and acted upon, especially in these times. When Doc started his first venture with exactly half of what he needed, the banks wouldn't loan him any money. I know that's just shocking to all of you. But Doc didn't let that slow him down. Working on the rigs in northern Alberta, he hitched a ride into Edmonton during spring breakup in 1949 and made his way to Calgary. He met with a company called Seismic Service Supply that represented the Mayhew line of equipment. and they had a method of financing their rigs through a small Calgary insurance company called Tate, Lowe's, and Myrtle. And now Doc could finance his dream. He resigned from his stable job and security, ordered the rig, flew the milk run to Dallas, and spent nearly a week waiting for them to finish it, but getting to know everything that he could about that rig. When it was finally mounted on the back of the new 3-ton truck, Doc climbed into the driver's seat and started that long, slow trek back up to Canada. It was mid-June 1949. The sun burned hot in the deep south, so Doc drove all night, and he slept in the heat of the day. Now, of course, Doc didn't have any money, so since the schools were out in the summer, he would find one where the yard seemed a little abandoned, and he'd park the truck there, and then he'd get out this old army cot that he'd bought and put it underneath the rig, and he'd go to sleep. And then in the morning, or whenever he woke up, he'd simply get into that truck and start driving. Although he did tell me that he found a few places where he was able to wash up a bit. So that long highway home took him to Coutts. You all know Coutts, the Canada-US border crossing. Now, unfortunately, he arrived on July 4th. And, of course, the border was closed. So with Calgary so close, yet 24 hours away, that last day felt longer to Doc than all the days on the road. Finally in Calgary, he had his rig, he picked up a water truck, and he had absolutely everything he needed to go to work. But one critical thing, a contract. And in those days, there weren't any. So at the beginning, the promises appeared as erratically as tumbleweeds, and they rolled away just as fast. Now, we know that Doc lived cheaply, but he did move up from that little cot underneath the rig. He stayed at the Y on 9th Avenue and 1st Street. It cost him a dollar a day. He spent another 50 cents a day on meals. But he was still stretched for some cash, so he leaned on Brother BJ, who at this point was working in the north with Western Geophysical. And he got a short run from them. And then Doc got an early education in how fast the oil industry worked. For more than 2 weeks, he'd spent the better part of each day canvassing all the companies, telling them where they could find him, and how he was ready to go to work. Well, one Saturday morning, a manager with Canadian Exploration Company came up to him and said, "Is that your rig over there?" And Doc said, "Yes, it is." And he asked, "You want to go to work?" And Doc said, "I sure do. I'll be ready first thing Monday morning." And the manager said to him, "The hell you will. If you want a job, you're going right now. Get your butt up to Hughenden. It's on the Camrose line, just south of Wainwright." And he sure did. So Doc Seaman was off to Hughenden, and the start of a lifetime career in the rush of risk and the weight of responsibility. That August 1949, Seaman and Warnke Drilling was officially born. By the end of the year, BJ was on board, heading up a second rig thanks to a little bit of investment cash from their dad, Byron, who believed both in his sons and the business opportunity. "Fundamentally," said Doc, "it was a family unit that made it work. We used all our own resources to do what had to be done. And there was the ethic, hard work, and loyalty that we brought with us." Don Seaman soon joined, working as a water jack, just as his two brothers had, and learning the business along the way. Don told me that he'd remembered how Doc didn't sleep much at night. He said he'd lay awake and come up with these ideas, and then, of course, BJ and I would have to carry them out. But he says we were a pretty good team. There was always something for us to do. Doc, of course, recalled that time vividly, and he said to me, "I would think of something during the night and could barely wait for daylight so I could get into work and try it out. Well, Doc continued to buy rigs, growing more debt and taking more risks along the way. His partner, Bill Warnke, was more than a little worried and wanted out. So Doc and his brothers were able to buy out Bill, and they changed the name to Seaman Engineering and Drilling Company, SEDCO. One of their earliest and best clients was Frontier Geophysical, and that was founded by Ted Rosa, a pioneer, as you all know, in the post-war oil industry. Ted and his wife Lola, in fact, became leading patrons of the performing arts in Calgary. SEDCO had worked for Frontier for a few years when the public accountant told Doc he couldn't find a contract with Frontier. "Well," Doc said to the accountant, "we don't have one." Now you can imagine how delighted the accountant was about all of that. He wanted to see a contract. So Doc went over to Ted and told him about the accountant's peak. Ted was not pleased. "We've trusted one another for years, Doc," he said. "We've given each other our word. We don't need a contract." Ted Rosa and Doc Seaman never did draw up a written agreement. They continued to do business with one another the way they always had. An understanding between gentlemen was far better than a legal contract, and that handshake always sealed the deal. Nothing seemed tougher, though, than getting cash to buy rigs. Everything Doc owned, earned, and mortgaged was tied up in the business. It still wasn't enough, and credit seemed impossible to secure. The Eastern banks didn't believe the Western oil and gas business was sustainable. The banks told Doc that he could have the money for a new rig if he could present a 3-year drilling contract. Well, we know who had all the big contracts, and they certainly weren't the smaller operators like Doc. But in the frantic day-to-day atmosphere of that oil and gas business, the only contracts available were hole-to-hole. The bankers wouldn't budge unless they had absolute, total, solid collateral. This was the early 1950s. Just wonder, how different is that right now? Doc finally found a willing merchant banker, Bill Holton of Charterhouse Canada. And they together found a public company for their private firm to buy, Hightower. It was a reverse takeover, with the smaller SEDCO purchasing the larger but public company, Hightower. And a number of years later, in 1962, Hightower was renamed Bow Valley Industries, because of course by that time they had acquired a number of other companies as well. "The essence of business is being able to measure risk and make it work," Doc told Gorgorenko over there. "Your enthusiasm and willingness to take risks is tempered by the amount of money you have. You have to know you can stand the hit from a dry hole and continue to go. It stays the same no matter how big you become. You don't want to sabotage yourself. To make the system work takes a lot of dedication and effort," he said. "The mechanisms of starting up and building a business are mostly the same in any industry, and so is the level of personal commitment. You really do not have any time off. There is a lot of sacrifice." And he talked about that to me, and I know he talked about that a lot to you, Gord. Doc Seaman led a purposeful life. He believed that old ways are usually the best ways. He didn't like seeing wealth used frivolously and selfishly without any social or community purpose. Doc grew up in a harsh time where depression and world war could have corroded character with vanity, greed, and brutality. And that did happen to some. Others had their health and sanity shattered by war. But not Doc. He retained the values of hard work and a pioneering spirit that defined small-town Canada in the early to mid-20th century. He was able somehow to set the horror of war respectfully aside while using its skills and lessons. The military taught teamwork and the need to make decisions quickly but intelligently. If they weren't right, you might not get a second chance, and others would go down with you. Doc's aptitude and attitude helped build a Canadian oil and gas industry and wrest it from complete foreign control. He took risks that were breathtaking, but never irresponsible. Some failed, but the big ones paid off. As in any life, there were sacrifices and tragedy, and the pull between family and work haunted Doc. He once told me, "I was working with the seismic crew and had to keep at it. It was July 1949, and I wasn't there at the birth of my first child, Diane." One message in Doc's life is that there is a way to success and to achieve a great many things while creating and preserving a flawless reputation. He did this by simply hewing to the values that built modern Canada: honor, respect, integrity, fair play, and social justice. Doc had a great deal of talent, indeed, a kind of genius in his ability to spot an opportunity and move quickly. His business life demonstrates this many times over, but his community abilities are even more striking. Nothing shows this more clearly than his insight into the potential of linking an NHL hockey team, a Coliseum, the Olympics, and amateur sport. There was a brief moment in time, and only that, when it was all possible. If any part of the plan hadn't worked, the whole project might have collapsed, and nothing at all could have happened. No Flames, no Olympics, maybe even no medals on the world stage in junior hockey. The only thing this huge success did, though, was shrink his bank account, but make him enormously happy and pleased with what he could do in the community. For Doc, it was another way to give money away. People like Doc have this way of making the improbable possible. Almost always, they do it by thinking far beyond themselves and their own interests. Now, Doc could have retired at 65, but he didn't. In fact, Doc and deals were synonymous, and so he became busier. Even after he was diagnosed with prostate cancer 17 years ago, Doc didn't stop. In the long preparation for the book, over literally scores of conversations that we had, I never once heard Doc complain. Well, maybe there was one thing, although it wouldn't even classify as a complaint. He said to me, "I haven't done enough." And even the last time I spoke with him, just before he went into the hospital, he was talking about what he wanted to do in the community. And that was Doc. You can never do enough when you're involved in the community. His last mission was to encourage the baby boomers waiting for this arbitrary age of 65 to completely ignore it. And instead, and if you were standing up here, this is what he'd tell you to do: take control of your life, keep moving, but most of all, stay in the game. And hence, called the book Staying in the Game. So, thank you.
I'm not sure Sydney would be pleased to
Any questions that you might have?